Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of ALS Crowd Radio. I'm your host, Seth Christensen, here as always with my co-host, Amy Christensen. We are thrilled today to have as our guest Dr. Eva Feldman of the University of Michigan. Amy?
Dr. Feldman received her MD and PhD from the University of Michigan and completed a neurology residency at the Johns Hopkins Hospital and returned to University of Michigan for a neuromuscular fellowship. In addition to her clinical practice and position as the Russell N. DeYoung Professor of Neurology at UM Medical School, Dr. Feldman is director of the A. Alfred Tubman Medical Research Institute and is the director of research for the University of Michigan ALS Clinic. She runs her own 30 Scientist Laboratory, the Program for Neurological Research and Discovery, and is the principal investigator of the first ever FDA-approved human clinical trial as an interspinal stem cell implantation therapy for ALS. Dr. Feldman has published more than 300 original peer review articles, 60 book chapters, and three books, and is the principal investigator of 5 major NIH grants. She is the past president of the Peripheral Nerve Society and serves as the president of the American Neurological Association from 2011 to 2013. She has been listed as the best doctors in America for the last 15 years.
Dr. Feldman, are you with us?
Oh, yes, I'm definitely with you. Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, it is our honor, and thank you for making time. I believe we already have a record number of callers on the line, so that is a good sign for today's discussion. As our topic, we have chosen ALS stem cell research, but thought we would open with a bit of a more broad question. We have known about ALS for quite some time. Are we learning new things about ALS today?
Oh, we certainly are, Seth. Every day we are learning something new about ALS. In fact, in the last 3 to 5 years, I think the new data and the new research and the new clinical findings that are coming out are probably surpass what we had learned in the previous 20 years. So now we understand, you know, new genetic causes of ALS, and that's giving us new clues on why everyone who has ALS may get it. So the sporadic cases of ALS, we are learning new imaging tools. We're discovering new reasons that there may be environmental and occupational exposures to ALS, and, you know, and then new therapeutics. So the field is rapidly changing. And in my 25 years as an ALS clinician scientist, so it's a long time, I have not seen such progress like the progress I've seen in the last 3 to 5 years. It's really remarkable.
We have heard that sentiment echoed among your peers and are thrilled to hear it as an ALS patient community. Now, your particular focus on the research is very broad and deep in a number of areas. Do you consider yourself a specialist in a particular area of ALS research?
Well, I'm interested in three broad areas of ALS research. One area that I've been interested in for a very long time is if there is an occupational or an environmental exposure that may predispose someone to developing ALS. So we currently have a grant from the Center for Disease Control where we're doing a very detailed study asking those very questions of our ALS patients, and in parallel measuring levels of like pesticides and different environmental exposures in their blood and their hair, and coming up with what I am certain will be new insights into answering that question. So that's one area. The second area I've been very interested in is developing new ways of imaging the brain and the spinal cord to better diagnose individuals very early in the course of ALS. Frequently, it takes a long time, at least a year. The average is a year to make the diagnosis. And if we could have a way to image the brain and spinal cord with our new techniques, we could make the diagnosis sooner. And why do I want to make the diagnosis sooner? Well, that's my third area of interest. I'm very interested in therapeutics, particularly cellular therapeutics or stem cells. And I'm very interested in the potential beneficial role of stem cell therapy in ALS. And I have evidence, both based on my clinical studies in patients as well as my preclinical studies in animal models of ALS, that the earlier we can perform stem cell transplantation, the more likely it is to have a benefit for ALS patients. So those are my three broad areas of interest.
Excellent. I know we could dedicate our show to each of those areas at least, but for today, would like to focus in on your stem cell experience and ask, why stem cells? What is the promise of this area of research?
So I will tell you a brief story, Seth, and that is I turned to the idea of stem cells approximately 7 years ago when I had spent almost 10 years on a clinical trial that failed in ALS, a clinical trial with a drug known as myotrophin or IGF-1. And I had spent almost a decade doing the preclinical work and then working on developing the clinical trial and doing a series of clinical trials. And I felt that that experience led me to believe that it's going to be difficult for just one drug, okay, to be beneficial solely in ALS. So we needed something, a combination of drugs, or, what about stem cells? Because stem cells, in a way, are really quite remarkable in that they can go into an environment, and in the case of ALS, the stem cells can enter the ALS-called environment, whether it's in the brain or the spinal cord. They can secrete growth factors, which are very good for diseased tissue and makes it healthier. They can form synaptic contacts. They can actually even produce neurotransmitters. They can become nerve cells. They can become supporting cells. So the promise of stem cells or my interest in stem cells began when I had the kind of the realization that it's never going to be, I think, just one drug that's going to really truly provide long-term benefit in ALS, but we need to go away from the single drug idea to what I'll call a cellular therapy. And that's where stem cells come in because they have so many beneficial aspects to them.
How long has our ALS research community been really interested in stem cell research?
I think for the last decade, there's been interest. For the last 5 years, there's been a great deal of interest. We entered our first patient in our stem cell, our FDA Phase 1 approved stem cell trial in January of 2010. We've now completed both a Phase 1 and a Phase 2 trial. There are now other very good you know, individual ALS clinics and groups of ALS clinics that plan to do similar stem cell trials, but maybe using different types of stem cells. So the idea that stem cell therapy is could potentially be both safe and beneficial in ALS has taken traction. And so there are several other new proposed trials besides our own. So I'm very excited about that and look forward to not only now doing the next phase of our trial, but also hearing and understanding new and different ALS stem cell trials that are coming on board.
Wonderful. Could we talk for a moment about your trial, the now famous NeuroStem trial? Could you outline that experience for those of us who are new to stem cell research?
Of course. So the NeuroStem trial has now been completed in both what we'll call a phase one trial and a phase two. Those are the designations by the FDA. So a phase one FDA trial is completed for safety, and it's really safety alone, with really not looking at efficacy, but looking at if the procedure is safe. And in that particular trial, we entered 15 patients for a total of 18 surgeries. So three patients got double transplants, and we were able to safely show that we can inject stem cells directly into the spine of ALS patients in the lower spine, as well called the lumbar spine area, as well as the upper spine known as the cervical area. And in that trial, we injected up to 1.5 million stem cells. And we continue to follow those individuals over time who remain active in the trial. So that is the phase one. So the phase two trial then is designed to continue to look at safety, but in this case, we also wanted to increase the dose of stem cells as well as do more stem cell injections into the cord. And I'm pleased to report that in that trial, which we completed July of this year, we again entered 15 patients and did 18 surgeries. Previously, as I told you in the phase one trial, the most stem cells that one patient received was 1.5 million. In this phase two trial, we got up to 16 million stem cells, giving 8 million stem cells in the low back and 8 million stem cells in the upper back or the upper part of the cervical cord, the spinal cord. These patients are now being followed. Again, safety. We have shown this procedure is safe to in both phase one and phase two. And now in phase two, we also begin to look at what we call exploratory clinical efficacy, kind of, you know, medical lingo for, is there a signal, a therapeutic signal? Do we see a difference in those patients who have received, you know, 8 to 16 million stem cells in the course of their disease? So now we've just completed this trial, and we've not looked at the data yet. We will not look at the data until 6 months after the last patient was entered, but that's going to be very exciting information for us to have at the end of the phase two trial, and is help guiding us as we plan the next phase of the trial, which we call phase 2B, phase three. When we complete the phase three trial, that's the definitive trial, and that will say whether or not this therapy can go out of the research arena into the more general clinical therapeutic arena where it could be available for all patients.
Thank you for that explanation. So 6 months until we look at the data, what would the ideal timing be for a phase 2B or a phase 3?
Boy, I'd like to say 6 months from now.
Yeah.
As soon as possible. So the ideal timing will be, we will need to carefully look at those data and we are hopeful to have an application in place in the winter of 2015, winter, early spring, with the goal of beginning recruitment as soon as we can. Again, we feel, Seth, you need to hear this, we feel the same. I feel the same sense of urgency that you feel. Everyone who works with me does. You know, everyone who has spent their life trying to understand ALS and develop therapeutics feels and embraces the same sense of urgency as the ALS community does. And so, because we're all part of the same community. So the sooner, the better. But we need to look at the phase two results before we can put that next application in.
Excellent. Yeah, indeed. Let's keep the pedal to the metal on this. And
it definitely.
You mentioned a moment ago other trials that are using different types of stem cells. We had Dr. Jeffrey Rothstein on a few weeks ago to talk about iPS cells.
Wonderful.
Can you speak about the type of cells we used for the phase one and two neurostem trial?
Yeah, so interesting because, you know, the name of the biotech company who has generously supplied the cells and has funded a great deal of this trial is NeuralStem, and these are actually NeuralStem cells. So these are stem cells that have the fate to become some type of nerve cell in the body when they're transplanted. And what we find, Seth, is when we place these stem cells in the spinal cord of either an ALS preclinical model, these stem cells become, about half of them become nerve cells, and the other half become supporting cells of the nerve cells. And what's also, just explain a little bit more about why these cells are likely so therapeutically potent, is in the ALS spinal cord, you know, the large nerve cells are undergoing a death, and then the surrounding cells look very inflamed and angry. So I call it a bad neighborhood. The neighborhood looks like it's in disarray. And you put the stem cells in, and the stem cells form, again, these contacts on the sick nerve cells and begin to nurse them back to health. And they also, all the inflammation around the sick nerve cells go away. The stem cells kind of clean up the inflammation also. So these neural stem cells become nerve cells and also these glial cells. And they have very, very, very strong therapeutic potential in the spinal cord.
Now, we hear a lot socially about embryonic versus other derived stem cells. Could you explain the difference between the promise of different cell lines?
I'd be happy to. So first, I think it's important to understand with embryonic stem cells how they are created, because I believe there's some misconception there. So in vitro fertilization clinics, a man donates sperm, a woman donates egg, and then in a small petri dish, the two are put together and embryos are formed. Many of those embryos are taken for transplantation into the woman, you know, to, of course, have children. Some are frozen, but most are discarded, literally, you know, put down a disposal. And so those embryos that would otherwise be discarded can be donated. So those donated embryos are then placed in a petri dish, and on day five, a small part of the donated embryo, known as the inner cell mass, is then taken and put in another petri dish, and that's the beginning of what's known as an embryonic stem cell. And those cells have the ability to become any cell in the body. They're called totipotent, meaning totally potent. They can become any cell in the body. So that's an embryonic stem cell. Early on, Seth, in our work in the preclinical, in the animal models of ALS, we looked at embryonic stem cells as a source of therapy, but come any cell in the body, when we put them in the spinal cord, many of them became nerve cells and glial cells, but they also could become other types of cells that we didn't want. So for our purposes, these cells were not good for therapies. As I mentioned, in the dish, you can grow this. You can grow the embryo to a later stage, and or you can receive donated fetal tissue, and then tissue that's been donated. You can take a small piece of, for example, an area that was going to become the spinal cord or the brain from a 2 or 3 week donation, and those can become stem cells. Those are called progenitor cells, or in this case, neural stem cells. They can become, or you could have take some that would definitely become a muscle cell, etc. So that's another type of stem cell, a progenitor cell. Another type, of course, are adult stem cells. And, you know, the use of adult stem cells or mesenchymal stem cells, which are from the bone marrow of patients, is currently being done. And there's a clinical trial about that. I'm happy to tell you about that, that's ongoing for ALS. And then the fourth type that's commonly discussed are these iPS cells. And I know that Dr. Rothstein just talked about those. And that's when you take a small, either your own blood cell or a small skin cell, and you turn that into an embryonic type stem cell.
I'm sure we're just scratching the surface here. Thank you for that. So to clarify, the neural stem trial was a progenitor cell trial?
Yes, it is. It was and will continue to be. This is a progenitor cell line. This is a stem cell line that was developed over 10 years ago and has been, you know, thoroughly studied, which is very good for us, and is also made in what we call GMP grade, good manufacturing practice grade, which the FDA insists on before you can use it in a clinical trial. So we chose this to work with neural stem because we saw these cells as being the type of cells that would be particularly therapeutically beneficial in ALS.
Thank you.
We're ready to go, too, I should throw in, you know, and we're ready to be used.
Excellent. We will pause for a second to have Amy invite listeners.
Hi, callers. Please call in to 516-590-0362. And to indicate that you have a question for Dr. Feldman, please push the number 1. Then we'll know you're ready for the questions at the end of the show.
Thank you, Amy. Now, Dr. Feldman, we have this exciting trial going on. What other trials are you involved with currently?
You mean my own, the other ALS trials that we're doing, or do you want me to talk about the other stem cell trials that other individuals are doing, Seth? What do you think people would rather hear about?
Well,
maybe the other stem cell trials?
Perhaps that would be the best use of our focus area.
I think so, because the other trials that I would discuss would be, you know, unique to our clinic. While the stem cell trial, our own stem cell trial that I just discussed, the next phase will be more broadly available to everyone in the United States, which I think is very exciting. And there are two other trials that, actually three other trials that are, that one that's ongoing and two that are in the active planning stages that should begin shortly. The one trial that's ongoing is a trial that's being done by the University of Massachusetts. I also believe it's Massachusetts General Hospital and Mayo Clinic, and that's a mesenchymal stem cell trial where a patient will come in, a bone marrow biopsy will be done, the mesenchymal stem cells, so the bone marrow stem cells are taken from their own bone marrow, and then they are processed and they're injected back into the patient's spinal fluid. It's the fluid that surrounds the spinal cord in the brain. And so that is an active, ongoing protocol currently. It's a different type of, you know, approach than we are using in our NeuroStem trial, of course, but I think it's, you know, an exciting new venue. Two other trials that are proposed, and I think will begin shortly. One is being done at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles by Drs. Clive Svensson, Robert Balow. And in this particular trial is similar to the trial that we have done with NeuroStem, in that in this trial they're going to inject stem cells into the low back, the lumbar part of the spinal cord. But these stem cells, they're not neural progenitors like the stem cells that I discussed with you. These are progenitors for the supporting cells of the nervous system, known as astrocytes. So it's a different type of stem cell, and another exciting part of these stem cells is that they produce a lot of one particular growth factor known as GDNF, which is very neuroprotective to the spinal cord. So that stem cell trial, I believe, is going to start in the near future. A third trial is actually being done at Johns Hopkins, and maybe Dr. Rothstein mentioned it, with Dr. Nick Marigakis. And he, too, is using a different type of stem cell. And I believe that his approach is going to be similar to the approach that both we have used and Dr. Svensson and Balow are using in terms of directly injecting stem cells into the spinal cord. So, you know, we go from no stem cell trials, right, in 2009, and we fast forward 5 years, and we now have one active trial doing intraspinal injections, our trial, the mesenchymal trial doing the injections around the spinal fluid, and then two new proposed trials. So the field's moving very quickly.
We love to hear that. I believe the mesenchymal trial is commonly known as the brainstorm trial.
Yes, it's commonly known as the brainstorm trial. And I just wasn't sure, since I didn't have brainstorm's permission to mention their name, if I could, but you did, Seb, so good.
I hope they're not too upset with me. And I am not aware of the other two common names, but we can.
So the other two trials, you know, the trial at Cedars-Sinai with Dr. Svensson and Balow, those cells were developed by Dr. Svensson himself, and that trial is being funded by you know how California makes a very large investment in stem cell work. And so it's actually being funded by the state of California, which I think is very exciting and very transformative. So that's actually being funded by the state of California. And then in a similar vein, the trial being done at Hopkins, I believe is being funded, I guess I'll say the name of the company, by a company known as Stem Cells, Inc. I believe that's correct. We may need to fact check that. But,
okay. Excellent. Thank you for that high-level overview. I know we have a record number of callers and would like to get to those questions. I know you were very gracious and interested in answering questions. We will go to our first caller. Caller ending in 0200. You're on the air with Dr. Feldman. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I guess my biggest question is for those that, you know, have ALS and are interested in participating in trials, how do they become involved with them?
So, multiple different ways. For those patients who have ALS, they are likely being seen in an ALS Association certified center or an MDA certified center. And those certified centers, so the centers themselves, of course, have a list of all the available trials. And for specifically the stem cell trial that I'm telling you about, the next phase, as I mentioned, we're going to make that trial available nationally. Previously, you had to be geographically located close to one of the three centers that was that were actually doing the surgeries. That's now going to be more open. And that, you know, information on that trial will be available on the ALS Association website. Clinicaltrials.gov is another good source, and also, in our particular case, the NeuralSTEM website. But if you go to the ALS Association website, the MDA website, or clinicaltrials.gov, that lists almost all the trials, and then your own physician will also, of course, be able to be helpful in the ALS or MDA clinic.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
All right. Thank you, caller one. We'll keep going down the list. And as a reminder, if you have a question for Dr. Feldman, please hit the number one and we will enter you in the queue. Our next caller ending in 8760, you are on the air.
Hi, Seth. This is Allison. We met in Florida. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Allison.
Hi. And Dr. Feldman, I wanted, and hi, Amy, if you can hear me too.
Hello.
Hi. And Dr. Feldman, I want to first thank you for dedicating your career to finding a treatment for ALS. My husband was diagnosed last year, and he's just 41 years old. And so, of course, we are very dedicated in wanting to find a treatment for the disease. I know that you're specifically talking about stem cells, but I was really interested in one of the first things you talked about your, you know, clinical interests and including the environmental and occupational factors that may be contributing to ALS. And I was wondering if there is anything that you have seen, you know, in the research that you have done or, you know, preliminary data that's been collected.
Right. No, that's a wonderful question. Yes, we just published a paper. It's a very preliminary paper, so I'm glad we're both using the word preliminary, showing that exposure to pesticides, particularly organophosphates, individuals who've had that exposure have a greater likelihood of developing ALS. And so that's like the first tick in the occupational or environmental exposure box that we have fairly firm evidence on. And that's only the beginning. Now, we also have preliminary evidence on what are called flame retardants, and that so exposure to both organophosphates, pesticides, and flame retardants in individuals who had exposure to those two compounds or sets of substances, their likelihood of developing ALS was up to 2 to 3-fold higher. So now this is preliminary. This brings up, though, a great point. Have you heard about the National ALS Registry?
Yes.
Yes. So that is a fabulous thing that our government is doing. So that is a registry of all living ALS patients. And when you go to register, there's about a 1.5 hours worth of forms to fill out or questionnaires, and they're surveys about occupations, surveys about your exposures, surveys about where you live in terms of, you know, is that meaningful if you live near a lake, near a toxic dump, et cetera. So I encourage everyone to enter the National Registry because those data, along with, I think, our own study, are going to help answer these important questions.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Allison. We will continue down our list. Caller 3, ending in 0899. You are on the line with Dr. Feldman. Caller 3, are you there?
Hello? Caller 3 right. Gave up on us, Seth.
I'm
here, sorry.
Oh,
Hello?
Please, caller,
Hello?
Go ahead. With...
Oh, hi. Thank you. Such an interesting, Feldman, thanks for your work. It's wonderful.
Thank you for the comment.
Just wanted to know about the qualifications for an ALS patient to participate in a stem cell trial.
Certainly. So we don't, it's a wonderful question. Thank you so much for asking. We don't specifically know yet because, as I mentioned, we are in the process of preparing the next application and we'll, of course, again, wait the phase two data for final preparation. But we anticipate we would like to enter individuals earlier in the course of their disease, so 3 years or less. And which brings me back to my very first point of the program. That's why early diagnosis, I think, is so important. So 3 years or less. And we are interested in entering patients who have a forced vital capacity, a respiratory capacity of at least 60%. And that's something that patients are tested for in their clinic regularly. And we're interested in entering patients who do have good speaking and swallowing. So they don't have a great deal of trouble speaking and swallowing. So those are going to be the entry criteria. I think the key one is less than 3 years of disease and then being able to have a forced vital capacity of 60%. And we used to have, I should tell you, again, we used to have to live in a certain place like Michigan or Georgia or Massachusetts in particular, but that no longer will be a requisite at all.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm, you're very welcome.
One more follow-up.
Sure.
One more follow-up. Just a question. In following some of what an Amy are doing, they, you know, looking at ALS CRAB, they're looking at the bringing in perhaps of big data to to you know ways of collecting data. And so I was interested in your first point of that kind of early identification of environmental factors and any thoughts that you have on maybe how new ways of collecting data?
Yeah, I think that's just a great question. Well, I'll go back to the National ALS Registry because they just published their very first their very first paper on the National Registry, and that is going to be a way for us to collect big data on all currently living ALS patients, and that is going to be extremely valuable. And they're going to make that data open to all interested individuals in academia so that we'll all be able to access that data to better understand, again, this is in particular environmental occupational exposures, but they also have a subset of individuals who they're going to their homes and they're actually drawing blood like we are doing, accessing hair, nails, and trying to understand in the home environment more of the occupational exposure. So now you couple that registry with what's also being done by the National Institute of Aging as one example where they are trying to collect blood and do genome sequencing, looking at all of your genes, right? That's 16 billion reads, as we call it. I mean, it's a huge set. And they've done that now on over 5,000 patients, and they're hopeful to triple that number. So if you combine the data of the genes with the data of the, you know, exposures and the registry data, we might really begin to get new insights into ALS. So combining and looking at big data are very, very important. And I'll finally add, and then I'll stop, is that I think organizations such as patients like me can also be very pivotal in providing data for academia and for these big data sets.
Thank you, caller, for your question. We will now go on. Sorry, we're having some feedback. We will now go on to our next caller, ending in 1243. Please go ahead, caller. Caller ending in 1243, are you there? may have lost them as well. Dr. Feldman, we have we could spend hours on any of these topics, but I wondered, as we wrap up over the next few minutes, if there are any other projects that you are excited about and feel we should mention.
Yeah, I'll mention one last before we close for the afternoon. Before I do mention it, I want to thank you again for having me and tell you what really an honor it is to talk to you and to get to talk to other individuals from the ALS community. As together as a team, we try to better understand what causes ALS and come up with new therapies. So thank you, Seth and Amy, very much. And so to end, I'll tell you about another project that I'm very excited about, and that is it definitely ties in with the environmental exposure project, in that what we now know is, you know, you and I were born with one set of genes, one set of DNA, but over time, what we do, what we're exposed to, changes that DNA. It's called, and that field is known as epigenetics. And epigenetics is how our DNA changes over time due to what we're exposed to as during our lifetime. And those changes in the DNA actually then result in changes in the what are known as RNA and protein that come from the DNA. And so what we have seen is that in patients with ALS, there's a clear, what I'll call epigenetic signature, a clear change in their DNA. And we believe, again, it's due to environmental exposures, but that is helping us try to understand how, for example, exposures to pesticides or flame retardants, how that would cause a result in developing ALS, so to understand what I'll call the mechanism of the disease. So this whole field of epigenetics is an area that my laboratory is very invested in, and we think will lead to new therapeutic targets in ALS. So I can end with that, with my enthusiasm for cellular therapy, stem cells, but also then for this understanding of occupational exposures and this field of epigenetics.
Thank you for mentioning that project. If we could ask one final question that we ask on all our shows, is what is the greatest opportunity for our listeners to get involved?
I believe the greatest opportunity is to get involved locally. So to get involved locally with either your ALS chapter, your ALSA chapter in particular, or possibly your MDA chapter, and or in your local ALS clinic, and or any very local groups that are involved. Like here we have something called Ann Arbor Against ALS, A2A3 we call it, and it's a local group that works with the ALS Association and the MDA. And I think local involvement is very important. Why get locally involved? To raise awareness, because, you know, this ice bucket challenge has taken a disease that you and I know well, but many people had never heard of, and has now made it nationally understood. So, you know, when you get locally involved, you increase awareness. You may or may not increase funding for the disorder, but importantly, you connect with other individuals who know and understand the disorder. So the more that we can increase awareness, I think it's extremely important. If everybody who listens to this program could, if they're not part of the National ALS Registry, register and tell two or three other ALS pals to register, that could make a tremendous importance. So local, I think to get involved locally with your organizations and what they are doing is by far the most important thing one can do. And I really do think together we can really come up with an understanding of this disease. And I always say, wouldn't it be great to have an ALS-free world?
Indeed. And Thank you for dedicating your career to our community. We deeply appreciate your dedication, creativity, and a life focus, and we applaud your efforts.
Thank you so much. It is truly an honor, I have to tell you, and a pleasure to work with the ALS community. You are the reason I do what I do every day, Seth. So thank you so much for everything you do for the ALS community. And you too, Amy. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay,
thank you.
Goodbye, everyone. Okay.
All right. For our listeners, a full transcript of this episode will be available on ALS Crowd over the next couple of days. Thank you to Dr. Ava Feldman for her time. Bye for now.